Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Court of Appeals for September 29. This is the third of our three oral cases that we're considering today. We have three non-oral matters as well. I am Judge Sleater presiding. Judges Bradfield and Cochran are with me on this panel as well. This case I'll identify for the record is the matter of Andrew Lowe Billette. Respondent Ruth Ann Billette is the appellant in this matter, A19-1993. And counsel, you'll note that we have the clock in the box so that you can see it. Let us know if at any time you cannot see it, but I'll presume you both can. So make sure to keep an eye on that in the usual course, 15 minutes for appellant's counsel, 15 minutes for respondent's counsel, and then of course, 5 minutes for rebuttal for appellant as well. The process otherwise is the same, other than we're all looking at our computer screens, which if at any time we run into any technological issues, we'll stop the clock and wait till we can get you back fully live so that we can hear you. We do ask that you mute as you are currently when you're not speaking. That seems to help with the audio as well. We are recording these proceedings in the usual course, and it'll be all this hearing and all hearings will be available on a judicial branch website within 24 hours. All others are prohibited from any recording in any way of this proceeding. We do ask that when you begin your comments, if you would identify your name for the record. And so we can start with appellant's counsel. If you're ready to proceed, you may do so.
May it please the court, counsel. I am Tammy Peterson on behalf of Ruth Ann Billette. I'm going to organize my remarks into the following topic areas. I'm going to talk about the court's imputation of income to my client at $15 per hour and the immediate imputation of that income upon entry of the order. I'm going to discuss the award of more than 50% of the marital estate to husband, the essentially reversing of the temporary award of attorney fees in the amount of $5,000, and by failing to conclude or consider husband's potential bonus income when establishing spousal maintenance and child support. We believe that these issues are an abuse of the court's discretion, and we are seeking a reversal on these issues. This marriage is what I would like to refer to as a traditional marriage, in the sense that it was a 25-year marriage. The wife followed husband around through many different moves across the nation while he pursued his occupation, meeting first on the East Coast and ending up on the West Coast for a while, and eventually they came to Minnesota. Her job prospects were minimal up until and including through the party's marriage. She worked in various clerical positions, and when they moved to Tacoma, Washington, she actually received employment via her husband's company in the late 90s to the early 2000s. In 2011, she sought a degree to do something for herself and to be able to show her son that he could challenge himself moving forward with his education. But she didn't use that degree other than working for her husband at his company doing special projects. And she eventually was terminated or let go from that position. And she found that out via mail through a retirement transfer. Upon trial, she had been homeschooling the party's child for 3 years at that point in time. And an important fact to consider is that the parties stipulated and agreed that she would be moving to rural North Carolina at the time that trial commenced. So turning to my first issue of $15 per hour, we feel that was an abuse of the court's discretion in imputing that amount to her. There was testimony on what she would be able to earn based upon her career, her earnings potentials, her social security history, her work history were all part of the exhibits for trial. And Ms. Billette had done research on various job opportunities in rural North Carolina. And she testified that she thought that she could find a clerical position, which she had done before, earning between $9 and $11 per hour. The husband's expert testified that she could earn substantially more if she decided to work in the area of information technology, a degree that she once held but was substantially outdated at the time of trial, and which the judge recognized the expert's viewpoint was based upon what she could be earning in the Twin Cities metro area. There was no analysis of what she could be earning in rural North Carolina. Despite the testimony being between the expert and my client testifying to her potential earnings, the court found she could earn $15 per hour. And I've scoured the record, and it seems like that amount was pulled out of thin air and was based upon an opinion of the court. And what was concerning for me is that the comments from the court seem to be saying that if she's going to choose to move to rural North Carolina, then that's her choice. But I think that she could make $15 per hour here. And counsel, I think that, yes.
Can I follow up on the evidence in the record and the court's decision? You stated that she had researched various job opportunities in North Carolina and found that she could earn $9 to $11 an hour. But my review of the transcript, she only testified to one job opportunity in North Carolina. And so, given that there's only, is that accurate or did I miss something in the record?
Your Honor, my recollection is that she had looked at job postings, but she did testify to one job opportunity that I believe was working for a church in a clerical position.
And that's my recollection as well. So there was only testimony as to a wage in one job opportunity. And given that your client only presented testimony, or there's your client only presented evidence as to one job wage or the wage for one job in North Carolina, how could it be an abuse of discretion for the district court to reach the decision it did when there wasn't sufficient evidence to determine what the average wage for clerical work in North Carolina would be, given that your client didn't submit sufficient evidence on that point? And there was evidence that she had worked in clerical positions in the past for, I believe, $12 to $13 per hour. She has a degree in IT. She's very well educated. So, and she had worked for $15 an hour in 2010. So given the evidence before the court, how was it an abuse of discretion to reach the $15 an hour amount, absent more information about North Carolina?
I think it was an abuse of discretion because there was no basis for it. If I could briefly talk about the $12 to $13.50 per hour, if we're looking at the location where she was earning those wages, she was working first in Pennsylvania on the East Coast in a metro area, and then on the West Coast in a metro area. And the earnings that she at $13.50 per hour were for her husband's company. And they had a policy that they had to pay her at her wage of minimally $12 per hour until she found other employment. So there was some help or assistance she received when she was getting those earnings. I think here what would have been appropriate, and it goes into my second argument that the court imputed that $15 per hour to her immediately without her allowing to move. I think that the court had discretion to allow her to move and then set up some sort of review hearing or a step up process, because part of the issue for my client was it was difficult for her to give concrete information on exactly what jobs she was applying for because she was in a holding pattern where she couldn't move to North Carolina until the house sold. And at the time of trial, the house was not yet sold, so she was stuck in Minnesota. So
would it not have been possible though to present more evidence on clerical wages in rural North Carolina in the areas that she was considering? I guess, you know, in other words, how can your client now complain about the result when the reason for her complaint is in part based on her failure to present sufficient evidence to the district court?
That's a fair question. I think that it was difficult because it was so speculative. At trial, she testified that she was looking at an area, a rural area, to move to. So I think it would have been disingenuous to simply provide a list of job postings in a 3-small-town area and state here a variety of wages. She found one that she thought that was she was well equipped to do, and that's what she testified to. And so I think that it would have been appropriate to allow her time to transition or move and then have some sort of a review hearing to ensure that she was truly seeking employment and what kind of employment that she was able to find once the house sold, once she knew exactly what area that she was getting settled in and what job opportunities were available at that time. Please keep in mind that neither party knew exactly how long that the house was going to sell. This could have been a 1-month process, a 6-month process, or a 1-year process. And she felt that she was unable to make that move until she had the proceeds from the house sale. So a lot of speculation.
I think I understand what you're saying about the move, and I track that, but I want to follow up on Judge Cochran's question about a failure of proof. So not having evidence in the record about what an average wage in North Carolina might be. I guess the next thing I want to know is, did you make this request of the district court that the district court not impute income until after the move, that there be some sort of review hearing as you've articulated to us?
Your Honor, I don't think that, I can't tell you that the actual words, please don't impute income to her until she moves. I can't say that those were made. I think that it was made implicitly because we were, she had testified to the court that her intention was to continue homeschooling the child until she moved and that she didn't feel that it was beneficial to go out and seek temporary employment here in the Mankato, Minnesota area until after she moved. So I think it was clear to the court that she didn't intend to look for employment right away and that everything rested upon that house sale. So along that same vein, we think that it was an abuse of discretion for the court to immediately impute that income to her because the court was well aware, and actually by the time the court issued its order, it did find out about a house closing, but there was no dispute that she intended to move to North Carolina, and the husband even testified that he thought it was reasonable that she would need a transition period. By immediately imputing that income to her, he forced her into a position where she would have to invade her property settlement, the house proceeds, in order to meet her expenses. By pretending that she was earning $15 an hour, it impacted the money that she had available to meet her own needs, but also importantly, the needs for her children, because child support was immediately set at $15 per hour too. I see that I'm so quickly running out of time, so I'm just going to move on if there aren't any other questions regarding the equitable distribution of property or what we feel was an unequitable distribution of property. I think that this just became confusing, and I've looked at this several times. I think that the testimony from husband made it clear that he anticipated the assets and debts would be divided equally. The court seemed to want to set up an equal division of assets and property, but looking at the court's own exhibit, the spreadsheet that they set up, the court awarded husband $428,000 of property and my client $409,000 of property. And the court in the motion for amended findings stated, well, we're only about $3,000 apart. But this is a circular argument because the court awarded the husband property and then gave him a credit for the attorney's fees of over $15,000 that he found my client was in need of. And he also gave him a credit for payment of the expert witness fees, which I view as essentially my client is paying her own, one half of her own attorney's fees she was awarded, and also one half of the expert fees. I think that those were separate issues. I think that the court should have ordered the husband to pay the attorney's fees and the expert witness fees separately, and then created a property settlement equalizer from that division. And I think if he had done so, my client was entitled to a little bit more than $9,000.
Ms. Peterson, can I ask you about that? And you made reference to the language in the amended findings, but if we were to, where the judge referenced it, the difference was less than 1%, I believe. But even if we were to disregard that and add back in or ignore the attorney's fees credit, and so if my math is correct, there's approximately $18,000 or $19,000, maybe up to $20,000 difference, which might be a little more than 2%. You've conceded the case law does not require exact dollars. Would a 2%, if my math is in the ballpark, equate to an abuse of discretion? How do we come to that conclusion?
It would, Your Honor, in a variety of ways. I'm not good with math, so I don't know about the 2%, but what I can show that in the findings from the court, one of the findings that he did when he was looking at my client's mortgage payment was to reduce her requested mortgage payment of $1,558 per month down to $1,000. When he did that in his findings, he said she should be able to utilize $100,000 from the proceeds from the house sale. Thereby, she doesn't need the entire mortgage payment in her budget that she's claiming that she needed. In addition, he didn't allow her any monthly amount for towards debt payments. She's only receiving funds. She won't be able to pay the credit card that she was ordered to pay, plus put down $100,000 on the house. She'll be left with less than that. There was testimony regarding her request or need. I think it was brought up by husband's attorney for $25,000 for the move. The bottom line, when you're looking at how the court provided the distribution of assets and debts, she doesn't have enough to pay the credit card that she's ordered. She cannot use the $100,000 she intended to and the court intended for her to use towards payment of the house. She'll be left without that. She has no funds left available. She has to utilize her entire cash award. So that makes for a very inequitable result. I see that I'm out of time.
And of course, you'll have the 5 minutes of rebuttal. Thank you, Ms. Peterson. And counsel for respondent, if you would identify yourself and then you may proceed.
Stephen Groshen. I'll wait for the timer. All right. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Stephen Groshen. I represent husband in this matter. I will be splitting my argument into what I think are the two main issues. A lot of the issues here are intertwined. The child support and spousal maintenance really are related to factual findings with respect to husband's bonus income and wife's imputed income on her. I will start with arguably what I think is the most interesting issue is the attorney fees. So how appellant cites Bone is essentially that it establishes a black letter rule that attorney's fees cannot be considered when the court is looking at the party's finances. Now, Bone relied on Filkins, and unfortunately, Filkins has maybe three or four sentences where it writes the rule that attorney's fees are not part of the marital estate, doesn't really elaborate on that. Since then, the Court of Appeals has ruled on it a few times. They clarified in Culliner, which is, let me get the citation, 2008 Min App Unpublished Lexis 75. And I will note this is in appellant's reply brief. In that case, the Court of Appeals, again, an unpublished decision, explicitly noted that an amount paid that has been reduced to a debt that relates to attorney's fees may be considered. And the proposition that I think that case points out is there isn't some black letter rule that the judge cannot consider attorney's fees in any way when he's looking at the marital estate. It's, I think what the court was getting at in Bone is that the judge couldn't just shift over all of the debt related to attorney's fees without considering everything as a whole. So respondent's position is that the district court did not err by considering the party's entire finances when it was doing the need-based attorney's fee award. And Judge, I see you've unmuted. Do you have a question?
I wanted to ask you about the Culliner case. Isn't that case distinguishable? Because in that case, it was in a credit card payment, and which is different than, you know, that's part of an asset or a liability, whereas these attorney's fees were not, the $15,000 that the district court considered were not part of an established credit card payment.
That's correct, Your Honor. Yeah. So I brought up the case for the point that there's not a black letter rule that attorney's fees cannot be considered, because in Colander it had been reduced to debt, which would apply to the attorney's fees in this case that were already reduced to debt, and the district court acknowledged that in its amended order. So with respect to the finances, what the district court was doing here was considering the position that wife and husband would be in after the property distribution, and determining, as interlaid throughout its order, that wife would probably have a shortfall of liquidity, that she was going to be receiving approximately $400,000, but some of that was locked up in the house. And so he ordered spousal maintenance to get her on her feet until the house was sold and she could have more cash to deal with some of those expenses, and then ordered the need-based attorney's fees because this is the exact word the district court used. It was more convenient than trying to shift around retirement accounts or anything else as far as the property distribution. So I don't believe that's an abuse of discretion for the court to consider the entire party's finances. Now, Bone wrote that specific findings need to be made. One, I would argue that the district court addressed this in enough detail in its amended order that there are specific findings. And second, I will note as a general matter, specific findings in property distributions are not required if the district court is familiar with the party's finances. The record is very clear that the district court is familiar with the finances because he rejected both of their budgets when it came to spousal maintenance. And the district court went through each expense, whether it was a yoga studio or anything else, and determined what he thought would be a reasonable expense. Also related to that is the wife's income. What's important to note is the court was asking questions about an abuse of discretion, but I believe the testimony related to wife was actually a factual finding. There's an omission in the district court order where he doesn't say not credible, but it's clear from the context that the district court found the wife's testimony not credible about the wages she could earn in North Carolina. The district court also explicitly noted that the expert who did an analysis in the Twin Cities did not do an analysis in North Carolina. So the district court was not relying on that for a specific market analysis of North Carolina. What the district court was doing was taking all the available information before it and coming up with a number. The way I read respondents' argument is that the district court would have to have a specific dollar amount from a job posting or a pay stub in order to impute income. And I don't see that in case law, and I don't think that's a reasonable position to require of the district court. Even if there are issues, as appellant argues, with the clerical positions on whether they were gained through nepotism or another mean, wife still has the education now. And I believe the district court's words were a very bright individual. She graduated with honors from her degree, and there's nothing in the record that shows she couldn't quickly educate herself and then move back into the IT field. And so what the district court did is it took the clerical positions, it took the IT field, and then essentially combined them, arguably well in the favor of wife, because her most recent job was $40 an hour. But again, not arguing that that's an error. It's what was well within the district court's discretion to come to that conclusion.
Counsel, do you agree that the income that was imputed or the wage that the district court arrived at should have been based on what she could earn in North Carolina, given that the parties agreed that she would be moving to North Carolina?
So, Your Honor, the issue within the community is she's not in North Carolina right now. They did agree for her to move there. But as already noted during questioning, there was no evidence to present what would happen in North Carolina. So essentially my answer is I don't know what difference that would have made. The judge used all the information before the district court to come to the conclusion of $15 an hour. And then again, did not find the wife's testimony about North Carolina credible. So all we essentially have as far as credible evidence, which clearly the judge implicitly found the expert's testimony credible about training. And from the order, it appears it was primarily relying on the expert to conclude that wife could quickly revamp her training and then receive a higher paying salary. My answer to that would be it doesn't matter because there's not information, credible information, according to the district court. And there's nothing in the record that I saw that would be clearly erroneous as far as the judge's conclusion on not finding her credible on that issue. The other issue I'll touch on with attorney's fees is whether the $5,000 temporary attorney's fee was properly taken from a joint account. In Pellant's reply brief, they argue that the district court argued it shall come from a joint account, but earlier in that specific language, the court says if the husband must take it from a joint account. So the position of husband is the must was eliminated when wife agreed from it to come from a joint account. So even though it's argued in appellant's brief that wife was in a desperate position and only consented to this because of that position, I didn't see anything in the record that actually supports that. Wife's testimony says that she agreed to it at the time, went from there. And again, the district court acknowledged this in its amended order.
Just to clarify, when would the must language be satisfied then in your view?
If she did not consent. So it would be satisfied if husband didn't have a collateral source or another source of income. Let's just imagine it's an inheritance. I'm trying to take it out of the marital property estate. And if he had to take it from the joint account and wife did not agree, then the must would trigger.
And a court order would be required? Or I'm just trying to play out how this would work then.
As far as the court order would have.
Well, you're saying if wife didn't agree, so then how would that play out after that?
He would have to get the money from a collateral source, and then that would be credited in the joint account.
Oh, I see. Okay, sorry, I missed. Didn't quite absolutely follow. Fine. Thank you.
Yep. I'll briefly touch on the marital property award. The appellant's argument is that the district court intended for equal distribution. It didn't. It intended for equitable distribution. It specifically said that in its amended order. It cited the case law that said it doesn't have to be equal. There's no formula here for exactly how property needs to be apportioned. Lastly, I'll touch on the bonus. Again, this is primarily from husband's position, a credibility determination. There was an employee from husband's work who testified about the bonus structure changing. Husband testified about the bonus structure and that it's simply too speculative. Doesn't use that exact word. The judge didn't use that exact word, but too speculative to attribute that income to husband going forward. And again, found that testimony credible. Very clear from the ruling. The case law cited it to argue that the bonus income needs to be imputed doesn't support that proposition. Those are cases where the district court was either affirming a conclusion where the Court of Appeals was affirming a conclusion by the district court that they could include income. So husband's position is not that the district court could not have included income. That's possible. That's within the realm of possibility. That can happen under the law. But based on the testimony in the district court's findings, it wasn't concrete enough for the district court to attribute it to a husband. And that's why in its discretion, making its ultimate determination, it did not include the bonus within the income. If there are no further questions, I will concede the rest of my time. Yes, Your Honor.
I have one follow-up question. Actually, I'd like to ask you the same question that Judge Sleater asked appellant's attorney, which is if we conclude that it was error to consider the attorney's fee amount in the property division, is that error sufficient, or is that error de minimis, or does that error require reversal?
It is absolutely de minimis, Your Honor. The district court made very clear, and this is one of the benefits of the rules that require motions for amended findings and trials before you appeal, that it gives the district court an opportunity to hear the arguments the Court of Appeals would hear, and then we get to see the district court's reasoning in response to those arguments. So again, these arguments were made, they were preserved in district court. And what the court concluded was, given the overall distribution of, again, 1% or 2%, however you want to crunch the numbers on this, that it is a very, it would be a very minor error. And the other thing I would note is a matter of, I guess, futility would be, if it were reversed, I think it's very clear what the district court is going to do, since it said it credited the attorney's fees.
Thank you. If we did reverse and remand on that issue, would we also have to reverse and remand on the attorney's fee issue? Because the need was based on the property division, you know, husband's ability to pay was based on the property division in the judgment and decree, right?
Correct. Yes. I agree with the court on that, because there would be no longer be a need for need-based attorney's fees if there's a different property distribution, as far as if wife received more assets, then under the district court's reasoning, there would not be a need for need-based attorney's fees.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Groshen. And Ms. Peterson, you will now have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll have the clock set and then you may begin.
I'm going to return to the property distribution. And I'm just looking at the chart that the court provided and looking at it, and I think that it's clear error. And so when I'm looking at the fact that it's undisputed that my client spent 25 years investing into her husband's occupation and following him around the country and raising her child, she's now moving by agreement of the parties with the minor child to North Carolina and has to start over. I've talked about the fact that the court chose to pretend that immediately she's making income that she cannot possibly make. When I look at the property division, both parties are set to receive $118,000 from the house proceeds. That's where it stops being equitable from a liquidity standpoint. As Mr. Groshen pointed out, the court was concerned about the shortfall in her cash liquidity. And in order to cure that, his suggestion or his order states that she has to take on a $19,000 credit card bill and pay for that, and that in lieu of paying a property settlement, that husband can pay the need-based attorney's fees. The court found she should be awarded of $15,000, and then she still receives less than 50% of the property. I'd like to point out that this credit card, because the findings to me were confusing, the credit card bill was incurred starting in the summer of 2017. The joint accounts had been divided between the parties. The husband divided the joint accounts and closed those. So wife didn't have any access to the marital assets. Husband testified that he paid out roughly $28,000 in attorney's fees from money that he earned during those times in the accounts. And then he also took on another $20,000 loan. My client had to use that credit card as her only means to buy groceries. It did incur some attorney's fees, care for the minor child. She didn't get child support until October of 2017, by order October 15th, 2017. So that was how she was getting money for her necessary expenses, whereas husband had access to all of the income he had been earning. It was almost a year to the date after the party's separation that she received a temporary spousal maintenance award. So during that year, she was left without him court ordered to help her pay with any of those expenses. So this debt was incurred prior to the valuation date in need for her ongoing expenses. And the court circumvented an equitable property settlement by pushing that burden solely on her after acknowledging she had little to no cash liquidity. And moving to the $5,000 attorney's fees, I think it's disingenuous for husband's to claim that wife had any sort of waiver. I think that, again, is just a mistake. The temporary order stated to the extent that husband must use marital property in order to pay the $5,000 attorney fee award, that would be accounted for. Wife consented to him using that account, assuming that it would be accounted for. Her in her testimony at trial, I believe it was on transcript page 230, right following the 229, the first few lines, she said, I want $5,000 off the top of that Vanguard account to properly account for the money that he took out and then have it be equally divided. She never had any sort of waiver, and husband knew she didn't have any waiver because at trial, he requested that he be credited back the amount that he had paid. And the judge denied that. Despite the fact that the judge did not allow him to receive a credit back for paying those attorney's fees, the judge's property division, the court's property division, in essence, did just that. The wife ended up paying for one half of her own temporary fee award because the husband got to use marital property. She's paying for one half of her need-based fee award because she's getting less than half of the marital assets. And she's also paying for one half of the expert fees, even though husband was ordered to pay those because she's getting less than 50% of the marital estate. And even after payment of all those fees, she receives a net amount of less than 50% of the marital estate. And we believe that's clear error and is not an equitable division of property, and it must be reversed.
Leader, can I ask one quick follow-up?
Yes, you may, Judge Cochran.
Thank you. Ms. Peterson, I didn't hear you directly address, and maybe you did, and I just didn't understand your argument. But I thought I didn't hear you directly address respondent's argument about the language must in the order relating to the temporary attorney's fees and that whether there was any determination that husband must use the marital property to pay that amount.
I think that's a creative argument now and the word is being completely misused. There was no testimony that husband had any other resources. I think the court was simply saying, husband, you can't use marital property because I'm ordering you to pay these temporary attorney's fees. To the extent that you don't have cash on hand of $5,000 and you must use marital property, the Vanguard account, it'll be accounted for later. Wife consented, there was no waiver, and husband didn't think that he was getting away with anything at trial because he asked for it to be credited back.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your thoughtful answers to our questions today and the briefing in the matter. We will now take the matter under advisement. We'll be issuing a ruling in the statutory time period. And in a moment, we will recess and consider our non-oral cases for today. You each have a good day.